Welcome, everybody. Silver Shield Report number 63. I'm here with the Gun Guys. I got Ben Gould and David Colvin. And they recently, Ben's a member of ours from a long time ago. He's actually helped out on a couple occasions, specifically with the Mulligan Mint and setting up their stuff. So he's been a real good computer programmer. And he's recently been working with David on this really cool site called MyGunValues.com, and I think it's a database with over 107,000 different kinds of guns and the current values of them and stuff like that. And we'll get into that later. The main purpose of bringing them on today was to get people more familiar with guns. I think everybody who's probably subscribed to the report gets why we own them. It's not really for hunting or personal protections. It's the last line of defense against tyranny. And that the number one killer, unnatural killer of humanity over the past century has been democide, where governments have the monopoly on violence, and usually it's unarmed citizens that are the victims of that. So we really don't need to get into a philosophical debate on why you need to own them, but I wanted to bring Ben and David on to talk about what a new person should do, because my parents had guns. They weren't, gun aficionados by any means. My dad had a revolver and a shotgun, and that was just about it. And then I went into the Marine Corps, and I became much more adept at using them and knowing them and using them and loving them. But even to this day, I'm still not somebody who would go out shooting on the weekend or stuff like that. I do own four different kinds. And I think every family should have at least one gun per adult member of their household. And we'll get into the different kinds. But Ben, are you there?
I'm here.
Ben and David, are you there?
I'm here.
That's good. Ben, can you tell me a little bit about your, experience of getting started with this? And then and I'll get to David, who's got just a plethora of gun knowledge, and maybe he can share that with some of our members here.
Sure. When I was younger, I didn't have any exposure to guns at all. It was not on my family's radar at all. Mm-hmm. And when I was, was like 22 or 23, I joined the Army. That was really my first exposure to firearms. And I realized that I actually really enjoyed shooting. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, my vision's not so good. But, I really did. I'm kind of a tinkerer, so I liked taking it apart, cleaning it, putting it back together, figuring out how things worked. So it was of interest to me. And then, I certainly liked the personal protection aspect of it. Once when I went to Afghanistan for a year, I had to carry around my M16 all the time. And like kind of when I got back, I didn't want to see another gun for a while.
Yeah.
But after the financial crisis and stuff like that, I started to really realize that, we could descend into a really bad situation pretty quickly. So I got more interested in it again. I was doing some freelance work on a website where you can meet up with people who want to hire you for their jobs. Dave's partner contacted me, and mm-hmm. we did a couple smaller projects together, and then now we work together on like an equity basis. So mm-hmm. it's
those are the best kind of relationships. I found that far too often people enter into business relationships as one guy over another, and I find that if people are willing to do it on a value for value basis, both sides end up working harder than it would be if there one was above the other. So I'm glad that that was something that you guys were able to enter into.
Yeah, I mean, it worked out really well. The first thing that Dave's partner said to me when I talked to him was, "Now, let's just get this off the table. How do you feel about the Second Amendment?" So, you know, we kind of like got the conversation started right away. And talking to these guys and learning from them was a really valuable experience for me. It really caused me to sort of go into Renaissance man mode and like mm-hmm. learn whatever I could as quickly as I could about the subject matter. So, you know, it's been really valuable to me, and I feel like I'm still new in the firearms world, which mm-hmm. I think gives our website and our angle from an interesting perspective, because a lot of the stuff that's out there is really geared towards
gun nuts.
People who are already experts, and yeah. you know, so that's kind of my story.
Also along the lines, you know, not only as a value for value basis, very important, but also having that kind of resonating ideological background, because and it's ironic, and I didn't, you know, recognize this until much later, but when I started working with Heidi, who's, you know, the sculptress that does our coins, you know, we originally came across her because I thought she was super talented, but little did I know, like, she's really ideologically aligned with a lot of the stuff that I do, and you know, she has done stuff for the U.S. Mint. And she really likes the way that we're doing it, and it's, I think, brought a whole different level. So it's good to bring in somebody who's, you know, on a value-for-value basis, is ideologically aligned, but, you know, maybe not have the full experience, because you coming in as a kind of a newbie, you know, you, since you're, you know, kind of the programmer, and you're translating, you know, what the experts want, you're able to bring a whole different level into it, saying, hey, I get what you're saying, but to the new kind of person into this, they're not going to get it. So here, this is how I need, this is, I think, how best translate your expert opinion to the kind of new person in there. And ultimately, that's what all good teaching comes down to. Things shouldn't be more complex. They should be more simple. David, tell me a little bit about you. I mean, how did you begin to compile 107,000 different types of you know, guns and stuff? Like, where do you get the database for this? And tell me the process behind it.
Well, the what got it started? I've been shooting since I was 5 or 6 years old, and hunting. And several years ago, my family was coming out here for a visit, and I have my own private shooting range. Mm-hmm. And my stepfather said, "Hey, can I bring my 357 and shoot it?" I said, "I don't care." Mm-hmm. So they were flying, and he says, "I can't find what the thing's worth." He said, "Nobody online has what it's worth." I said, "Well, it's worth, you know, about this." So, because he wanted to insure it for the flight. Mm-hmm. And about that same time, I had a couple of experiences at local gun shows where dealers were being very dishonest. And my stepfather, who is the other partner that Ben's mentioned, he said, "You know, we need to do a database of firearms values, because there's nothing like that out there." Mm-hmm. And that's how we got this started. As far as how I built the database, I already had quite a collection of firearms reference material. I just started adding to it. Mm-hmm. And I've
so
got
this
some
like a personal passion, like you just naturally like doing that.
Yeah, like I said, I had my own private shooting range, yeah. So and it was one where, you know, you always want to retire, or you always want to be able to make a living doing what you love.
Yes.
And while I'm good at what I do in my day job, it's not my passion. It was just what was there to pay the bills when I was 18, and I've always stuck with it. And this was a way that I could see to fill a need out there that didn't exist, to help the average person who may not be the most firearm savvy. Because when we built this database, I tried very hard to make it for people who, they might understand what a barrel is, what a trigger is, what a stock is, they really don't know the basics. And that's how we designed the search parameters on this, so they could really get in there and find their gun. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how, and then like I said, it's taken almost 5 years to get to this point, just building the database, because yeah. We wanted it to be as accurate as possible.
Yeah, and I take it it's something that you know, you as a gun person may totally see all this information, and in your mind it's very clear. But you need a guy like Ben to be able to say, okay, let's put it on the web. Quick question. How do you fly with guns? You know, is this something that you have to put it in a checked bag, or like, how does that work?
Okay, it depends, A, on the state you're departing from and the state you're arriving into.
Okay, so let's clear that up. Like,
in the vast majority of the states, it's very simple. You check the firearm as unloaded at baggage claim, mm-hmm. and it's changed a little bit since 9/11 mm-hmm. in that now the TSA will make you open the case again after it's checked so they can go through it. Mm-hmm. And then most manufacturers allow 11 pounds of ammunition. And while some of the less experienced, that might sound like a lot, if you're making a 14-day trip to Africa, 11 pounds of ammunition is not a lot.
No.
And so that's what you do in the vast majority of the states. It's pretty much a foregone conclusion that if you're going to fly with firearms, you don't want to go anywhere near any New York airport. Mm-hmm. Or Chicago O'Hare. Those California. Are the ones. No, California actually going through their airports isn't bad.
Okay.
They do have transport laws that you have to obey. Mm-hmm. If you live in California, I definitely suggest.
Is this something that's on your site too, or is there like a website that has this broken down too? Because I think that would be pretty valuable too for people to understand.
Yeah, there's a website out there. The name of it escapes me, but it is. It's the Firearms Laws of the 50 States is the name of the book, and there is a website for it.
Okay. And then just so I know that I always do the, molestation versus radiation going through TSA, but when they, do the search on you, does having gunpowder or being around it set off things? Because, I haven't been around firearms prior to travel, but do you guys have any idea about that?
I have, and it's never been an issue. And I'm like you; I usually select the molestation versus radiation. I never heard it that way, but I like it.
Yeah.
It's never been an issue with me because, after you're done shooting, you wash your hands. That's going to take most of the residue off. The only issue you might have is if they happen to have a bomb sniffing dog. You might have to do some explanation. But. You know, it doesn't take long to figure out that you don't have a bomb hidden in your underwear or your shoes, when they're sniffing your hands.
Yeah, exactly. all right. Well, I like the idea that both of you guys, I was talking to Ben prior to the call, both of you guys really found your passions, when you were early on. And I'm a firm believer that most people know what they want to do at 7 years old, but rarely have the balls or the encouragement or the support network to actually go ahead and do it going forward. Ben, you said that you were doing programming since you were 6 years old.
Yeah. I'm 32 now. So, mm-hmm. Back then it was like in the 80s, there was no internet. They didn't have modems. You couldn't do anything. So mm-hmm. My parents were... they did get a computer pretty early on, which I'm kind of actually thinking back about. I'm kind of surprised about, but they did. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, here, you can use this if you want. But there was nothing to do on it except that back then computers came with instruction manuals. Mm-hmm. And in the instruction manual, it told you how to program the computer. So I kind of was like, all right, I'll try this. And I really got into it. And I would make games for myself and stuff like that. And then,
that's crazy.
Yeah, as time went by, I just started seeing all of the technological advancements. I first got on the internet with like a dial-up modem and it was all text. The web had just been invented. It didn't have any pictures or anything. Mm-hmm. And I really saw it evolve there, and I just kind of kept learning and learning and learning. And then I actually had the idea about being a programmer kind of beat out of me in school.
Yeah.
And there in high school, I even I went so far as I entered programming contests, and I took the money and I had the school buy the software they needed to teach other people how to do programming, mm-hmm. because, I saw that there was an interest for it. So, I started going to college for other stuff. I dropped out. After I got out of the Army, I went back to school to get my I call it a receipt, but I got my degree in computer science. So,
yeah.
So that, you know, that's kind of how I evolved into that. And it's worked out really well for me. You know, I don't know what I would do if, like, there wasn't a need for computer programmers anymore, yeah. But I know.
And that's a reality that you may have to deal with for at least a while. If we have the kind of dollar collapse that I think that we're going to end up having, I think that a majority of the need and value of the internet is going to diminish significantly as people's, values go back to survival, go back to, basic necessities before. I mean, I got to imagine the grand majority of the internet is really just frivolous stuff that doesn't, you know, is not very pertinent to survival. So, I mean, you are hooked up with gun people, silver people, and my thing. So maybe you'll be fine. But I got to imagine the majority of the programmers who are making their money off of the corporate teat, are probably not going to be in the best positions because, if the economy ceases to function as it does, so goes, kind of the milk cow of what's going on.
Yeah, and just like everything else, there's a big bureaucracy. So, it's a real good point.
And I think that, you're going to see massive decentralization of power, and those bureaucracies are going to cease to have the amount of power that they have, through issuing debt and money. And it's going to come down to, individuals, doing a value for value basis, and whether that's, criminal psychopaths doing that, I'll do this and you do that for me, or just individuals, trying to survive or working with people that they know and respect and want to build some sort of semblance, power is going to devolve. So it's key that I think it's most important that people find what they're passionate about. Hopefully that passion has value for others and is not of a frivolous nature, which I think both of you guys have. I don't know maybe so much about me, but internet philosopher, I don't know how much value that's going to have. David, we were talking about how you were shooting since you were 6 years old. Tell me your progression with guns and how you were brought into the gun culture and, maybe some of the lessons that you learned young that has translated well for you growing up.
I started shooting just because, grandpa shot and then dad shot, and I would go on rabbit hunting trips with them. Mm-hmm. And at like most kids, I believe from back in the 60s and 70s, you started shooting, and this is probably still true today, you start shooting with BB guns and 22s, mm-hmm. and you gradually progressed up the food chain. And then when you leave home, cash is a little hard to come by, so you make do with maybe a shotgun and a 22 or a shotgun and a 30-06. Mm-hmm. Originally come from Ohio, which when you were deer hunting in Ohio, you can't use a high-powered rifle and haven't been able to for many, many years. Mm-hmm. So, shotguns and 22s are pretty much the norm back there. So I now live in Washington State. Mm-hmm. When I moved out here and rifle cash was a little easier to come by, I began building a collection, trading, buying, selling. Here in the wide open areas, you can high-powered rifles are pretty much required for any kind of hunting. So I kind of went away from the 22s and the shotguns and began shooting a lot more rifles. I tend to gravitate more, although I do own many modern firearms, including a couple of AR types. Mm-hmm. I tend to gravitate towards the antique firearms. When I'm going to go out shooting just to have fun, I'll usually grab one of the antique lever actions that I have in my safe. Mm-hmm. And I guess the biggest thing I've learned is to be yourself when you're selecting a firearm and when you're shooting a firearm. You select what A is interesting to you, B you can handle well, mm-hmm. and C what's not going to scare you.
Yeah.
Because read a lot of the firearms publications today, they'll tell you that, a 30-30, which is a round that was invented in 1895 by Winchester. Mm-hmm. It's killed probably more deer or as many deer as any other round in the history of the United States. Mm-hmm. Perfectly adequate for killing any deer on the planet. Mm-hmm. But the gun magazines will tell you, no, you need the super whiz-bang mega magnum to kill this big northern whitetail again. And you don't need it.
Yeah.
So you go out, you find something that you can handle well, because what good's, you know, if you blow a hole clear through the deer, a heavier bullet going faster just means it's a bigger hole and you ruin more meat.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I kind of get the thing about finding something that's right for you. Like when I got out of the Marines, the first thing I bought was a 9mm Beretta, because that's what the Marines carried, and I was like, all right, you know, if I'm going to get that. But I found that I really did not like shooting it. It just seemed too big for even me. And, you know, I'm 6 foot, 200 pounds. It's not like I'm a little guy. But I just bought a Ruger LC9, same size round, and holds, I don't know, a round or two less. But, man, I love firing that gun. It's a good concealed carry gun. I can shoot reasonably well with, and I handle it better. Does it look as manly as the Beretta? No. But you know what? I like it because I can handle it better. So tell me like some of the things that people should look for. Like somebody who's brand new to the thing, what's the first type gun they should get? What should they look for? What, you know?
There's so many different ways to answer that. Yeah. Let's assume the person, given the current political environment.
Well, here, I'm going to give you the typical member. 35 to 55 years old, father, got, you know, new to this thing, you know, what are they looking for?
Yeah, we're assuming self-defense and not hunting.
Yes.
Self-defense, you said it. What are you comfortable shooting? Most areas will have a shooting range that rents firearms. Mm-hmm. My first advice is to find that shooting range in that gun shop and go rent a wide variety of firearms and see what fits you well.
The test drive. You know, it's the same thing you would do with a car. You know,
you wouldn't buy a car without a test drive. When you go to the department store to buy a pair of blue jeans, you go into the fitting room and try them on. Guns are just the same way. Different grips fit your hands differently. Different calibers recoil differently in different weight guns. The worst thing you can do is take some salesman's advice on what you should buy.
Yeah.
You definitely have to find what fits you. My usual recommendation for a woman, because we're assuming unexperienced people here, mm-hmm. is to buy a revolver, usually no bigger than .357, mm-hmm. because they, you know, it's what they can handle. But again, go to the range and try it out.
Yeah.
Semi-automatics, usually you want to start, you know, at 380 ACP, which is a short version of the 9mm. Mm-hmm. Go upwards from there. And my, but I'm an experienced person, but when I carry a semi-automatic for self-defense, I usually either carry a 40 Smith & Wesson or an old 1911 in 45 ACP. But again, it's that test drive's all important, and It's what fits you. And somebody like me who's 6'2" and 260, mm-hmm. versus somebody like Ben who, 5'8" and about 190?
Yeah, well, I'm 5'6", like, 190.
Okay, what works well for me won't work for you. So my first advice is to find that place that'll rent you the gun and try 15 or 20 of them if that's what it takes.
Yeah, because I remember prior to going into the Marines, I really had no experience with handguns. My father would never let me touch his revolver. We certainly never went shooting. I did do skeet shooting, and I found I was pretty adept at that. Went into the Marines. We worked with the M16. You know, later on we got the M4s. I'm a hell of a shot with rifles, and then I found that when it came to handguns, I couldn't shoot anything for 30 yards. I mean, it was just... I couldn't hit the target, and I found that as soon as I got rid of the 9mm, and my friend had a Sig Sauer that he bought, I was much better at shooting. Like, you know, you hit the targets, maybe not put a good tight group on, but the Sig Sauer trigger was just so much easier to pull back. The resistance wasn't there, and it fit nicer in my hand. And then now that I've gotten older and I got this little Ruger, you know, I could put a mean set together. So yeah, I love the idea that people should rent these things, do the gun ranges. So we go from my experience is I think everybody should have every man should at least have a handgun in the house. I don't care if your whole family's against guns. If you're against guns, it's better to have a gun and not need it than need it and not have it. And if I like the idea of the revolver, there's a big difference between a revolver and a semi-automatic in terms of reliability and ease of use. You're not going to get the amount of rounds out of it, but if it comes to an experience where you need one round to get off, that's the gun to have. So maybe go for a little bit of difference between why a revolver over a semi-automatic, and maybe talk about better brands, like which brands are good to look towards.
Revolver. The thing that makes revolvers, right? Let's be specific here. Double action revolvers. Let me give a quick definition. Mm-hmm. Double action revolver, you pull the trigger, the gun fires. Single action revolver, you must pull the hammer back manually. Mm-hmm. That's generally not an accepted self-defense weapon unless you're somebody who's fairly experienced with them. Mm-hmm. But for a newbie, you want to go with a double action revolver. Again, all you do, you load the cylinder. Usually you only load five, assuming a six-shot revolver. You always want to keep that empty chamber, the hammer on an empty chamber to prevent dropping it and accidentally firing it. And you simply put, it's point, pull, and pray. Mm-hmm. If you somebody breaking into your house, all you have to remember is to squeeze that trigger. Mm-hmm. Whereas a semi-automatic, you would know from your time handling 9mm, mm-hmm. that you have to remember to rack it, take the safety off if it's cock and lock, and many other things. Yep. So as far as what manufacturers to go, Smith & Wesson has made firearms for, 1852 to today. What is that, 165 years, if I'm doing my math right. Mm-hmm. They've got it pretty well down. And built in America. You can buy a lot of import stuff, and you can buy on the cheap. But fact of the matter is, Smith & Wesson builds some pretty doggone good revolvers. I own several. Mm-hmm. Ruger builds some nice double action revolvers, again built in the United States. When you get into the offshore stuff, such as Taurus and Pieta and many other brands, mm-hmm. that you can have reliability problems. You can have problems with the service after the sale.
And I gotta also imagine that affects the aftermarket values of these
very much
guns too. Kind of relating to the silver business, if something isn't as reliable or has the name recognition, the liquidity of them may not be as strong. Sure, you'll be able to just sell a revolver, but if it's got a better brand name, better reliability, ease of use, and a better brand recognition, you're far better off opting towards that than saving $50 or $100 getting something cheaper. Because it may actually end up costing you hundreds of dollars, because that Smith & Wesson is going to have either hold its value or appreciate in value faster than, like a Taurus you recommend, like you said. Well,
I have quite a nightmare story to go with Taurus, but suffice to say I was not impressed with their customer service when it took them 9 months to replace a defective gun.
Wow.
As something you had said earlier I wanted to touch base on. Mm-hmm. You had said you believe that every man should own a firearm.
Yeah.
I disagree with that for the following reason.
Okay.
You have to be able to, you have to be willing to use that firearm. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, there are men out there who would get it taken away from them and get it used on them.
Yeah. It's funny because with the report that I just did last week was called The Warrior Spirit. And it was we did a whole hour on self-defense, hand-to-hand self-defense. And the whole purpose of even that conversation was talking about having the instinct and the will and the, in your mindset to be able to do that. So I fully agree with you. Don't show a gun. Don't own a gun unless you fully intend to kill whatever is in front of you. Can you go a little bit more on that? I don't know if you have stories about that or just...
I've had a concealed carry permit in the state of Washington now for over 20 years. Mm-hmm. In those 20 years, I've only had to pull it out once. And a gentleman, advisedly tried to yank the passenger door open on a service truck I was driving. Mm-hmm. And I got the thing about out about 6 inches, and he saw it all, and all I saw was elbows and sneaker bottoms. That's the biggest misnomer in today's media and the misinformation that they give us.
Yeah.
Is that you have to use the firearm for it to be successful.
Oh, no.
And we're talking hundreds or thousands of times to one.
Yep.
All it takes is the presence of the firearm. It never has to be discharged.
Yep.
For it to be defensible. And I mean, when you live where I do, I mean, I've had bear on my property. Mm-hmm. I have cattle. Mm-hmm. I've had coyotes on my property after calves, raccoons after animals. So, I mean, pest control is always there too.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's your big thing right there.
Yeah. And I think that having that mindset, and, you know, I guess I'll have to couch that little line about every man owning it. I think we are heading into a time where it is going to be dangerous, and that men really need to cultivate that sense of righteousness, I guess, of being able to produce a weapon and use it effectively. I think that, you know, for this past generation, at the very least, that sense of, you know, boys going out there hunting with their fathers and having that sense of being able to use it has been driven out, and we've been more or less feminized into, you know, these couch potatoes that don't really get what's going on. I think when I went into the Marine Corps, I came from a football, rah-rah, listen to heavy metal type thing. But in order, when you got into the Marine Corps, and maybe Ben can talk about this too, you really do get indoctrinated into being a trained psychopathic killer. I mean, we would not only carry your rifle everywhere, you would almost worship the damn thing. In the Marine Corps, almost everything was kill, 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 and, kind of get that mindset. And, to take an average person, to get to the mindset of, if you're going to produce a weapon, you're going to use it, you're going to kill, and you're going to sleep well at night knowing that you did the right thing. That's something that I don't think the typical American guy has that in their mindset, even though they may own a gun. And Ben, can maybe talk about a little bit about your boot camp experience? Because I kind of get the feeling you didn't come from a pretty, rough-ass background. We were talking about how you were pretty much a computer nerd and in school and stuff. What was your experience going in the Marine or into the Army?
Well, it's very much like you describe. When you're in boot camp, they do try and get it so you can shut off your mind.
Mm-hmm.
If and not even think about what's happening in front of you. Like the way they train you to shoot, at least on the Army side, I don't know what they do in the Marines, but they have like a range where, 25 yards, 50 yards, 100 yards, 125 yards, 150 yards, they have sort of body shaped targets that pop up, and then you get like a 30 round magazine, and they might have 25 targets that you need to hit or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. Or actually I think there's a reload in there. So it's probably more than that. But, mm-hmm. Anyhow, the targets pop up maybe one every 3 to 5 seconds. And then and then you might get a when two targets pop up, and you have to hit both of them within that 3 to 5 second span.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is that, and I've looked into this, is that it's really training your mind to just be, when you see that like human shaped target,
mm-hmm.
you're just shooting for center mass. You're not thinking like what kind of weapon does he have? Okay, I got to hit the center of that shape. And once you do that, it's not like you're hitting a person.
Yeah.
So that's a valuable, it's a valuable skill to have for combat. And the reason they just train it like that, to really speak to what you're talking about, is that in World War II,
most people didn't even shoot.
Right, because they were used to looking at a bullseye. Mm-hmm. So they might be able to hit the bullseye every time.
Yeah.
But they, in their mind, they would think, oh, you know, that's another person over there.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to be in this war. That person probably doesn't either. I don't really want to shoot them. And if you're defending yourself and you're mixed up in those kind of thoughts while you need to be protecting your family, it is something you need to mentally prepare for.
Yeah.
So that was actually one of the things that I had to look at myself before I even bought a firearm after I was out of the Army. Mm-hmm. Was like, you know, I needed to work through it in my head and say, like, you know, if I need to protect myself, like, what do I think about that? What do I think about killing another person?
Yeah.
And, you know, I kind of came to the realization that it's like, you know, if you're doing it in self-defense, if you're not doing it to show off or be a tough guy or anything like that. Yeah, exactly. Like, they may not have any qualms about doing something to you. So if you're in that situation, you know, I kind of have this argument with people sometimes because they say, like, well, if you buy a gun, what are you going to do? Like, you know, what if there's an insurrection? So you're going to cause an insurrection? And I just tell them, like, look, you never know what could pop up around you. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I look at it is, you know, if you're in a situation where you're threatened, if a car was coming at you, you would jump out of the way.
Yeah.
If, you know, if somebody wanted to get in a fight with you, you would either try and remove yourself from the situation or fight back. So yeah. if somebody's, you know, that's just the way I look at it. And, you know, I think it's not that hard to mentally prepare yourself. Mm-hmm. And I would kind of use the same strategy that the military uses and actually shoot at silhouettes that are like people. And I think that's what most ranges do anyway.
Yeah, and I've also found that maybe even the target shooting isn't good. You know, the static shooting, and I don't know, David, what kind of range you have or whatever, but my best experience was two occasions that I got to do more, I guess, tactical shooting, a lot of moving you know, moving multiple targets and stuff like that. The idea that you're going to be, you know, I guess this sort of relates to our discussion last week with the difference between self-defense and taking somebody out, which is what Coach David really talks about with his, you know, tactical fighting. The idea that you're going to be in the perfect position with your ear pieces on and, you know, your glasses and you have the right, you know, center, you know, stance and stuff like that, and you're able to, you know, perfectly air-conditioned environment is not really training you to be able to handle a firearm in a situation where your blood is pumping, you got tunnel vision, you can't hear, you got that ocular, I forget what dissension or whatever it's called, where you can't quite hear as well, and you know, you're nervous, and that's why I really like the place that I went to. Where they, you know, you had an instructor walking right behind you the whole time and yelling at you, like, you know, do this, do that, do that. And you know, you're trying to listen to him, but still get rounds on target. What has your been experience with, like, what kind of firearms training have you had that you really, that you would recommend or have people look forward to? So, you know, they got past the renting, they finally have a handgun that they like using. Can you give some, you know, things on how best to train once they have it?
Now, this is not a range that exists in all areas of the country.
No.
The moving type target range, for instance, there is not one in my immediate area.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing is obviously being able to hit with game at, but it's important you do that from what we refer to as field positions.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, you're not going to have your eye protection on, your earmuffs on, stand there with your two hand square stance. Shoot prone, shoot from one knee, shoot laying down. Obviously do it safely.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that you're hitting your target, but just standing there practicing hitting a bullseye is not good. You need to practice from field positions.
Mm-hmm.
Shooting over a bench, not going to do it. Those are important. If you do have a range locally where you can practice moving and you're really serious about your self-defense, I highly recommend that is the best training you can have.
Yeah.
Now, as far as sight alignment, it's very important you get used to the handgun being an extension of your arm and your hand. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is in a tactical situation, you will not see those sights. Okay, the sights will be secondary. You're just pointing.
Yep.
And unless you are a really, really trained Marine police officer who's been trained under that kind of stressful environment, those sights are secondary. You're just pointing and pulling. Mm-hmm. And that's why I say point, pull, and pray. You have to get used to the fact that that's what's going to happen. Once your adrenaline gets going, you're not going to think about sight alignment. You're not going to wonder. You have to get used to those center mass hits, and that's why the military trains you that way. Mm-hmm. You're trying to put holes in him before he can put holes in you. That's really what it boils down to, and that kind of training is probably the best. There are several specialized centers all over the country, if you're really serious, that do tactical defense training. But for the average person, it's probably out of the cost because they are quite expensive. But if you do have a range where, like you went to, mm-hmm. you can practice on a moving target, that's your best. You know, with an instructor, that I really highly recommend that for anybody who can do so.
Yeah, and honestly, like, not to kind of downgrade it, if you do it for like a day or two, not that you're going to be, you know, super awesome expert, but that kind of experience will literally live with you a lot longer than, you know, doing the hour at the gun range every other month and stuff like that. Like, if you get to go to a place when you're there for a day or two and really get to do it and really think about it, it becomes second nature fairly quickly. When I was in the Marines, one of the first things they had us do when we were at the gun range is the idea that, you know, we're kind of brought up with this video game and movie mentality where you can run and shoot, and it's a complete impossibility. You know, you can't. You know, I watched one of my favorite gun movies was Desperado with I don't know, one of those movies, and they're in the bars and they're flying sideways and they're like kicking bullets, you know, downrange, and it's just a complete farce. What the instructor had us do is we had a target only, I don't know, 10 yards away from us. I mean, it was not far, and we're with a rifle, and they said, I want you to run at it and shoot it. And so that's what we did. We ran and shoot at it. I mean, it was completely insane. And, you know, the average guy maybe get one out of 10 shots on target from 10 yards away with a rifle because they're running. And, you know, one of the lessons that they taught us was, now, instead of running, just take a knee and shoot. And you get 10 shots in, and he goes, the wonderful thing about bullets is that it covers a lot more ground than you will, and you're far more effective just taking a stance anywhere and laying down good, accurate target than it is to try to move yourself closer to the target. So that really sit with me, and I was like, yeah. But coming from the kind of the culture that we have, you know, we're almost – you know, taught that, oh, somehow running and shooting is a thing.
And it doesn't work that way. And you are 100% correct that's why I said field positions, laying down, kneeling, you know, dropping to one knee. That's the important thing. You're going to hit nothing if you're moving. Mm-hmm. It's virtually impossible to hit a target if you're moving, because as your arms and legs and everything are moving, you can't hold that gun that steady. No, you know, it's almost a physical impossibility. So I agree wholeheartedly that's what you need to do. The other thing you had said earlier was you were discussing where people in this country are trained to believe that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I don't know if you meet them, but in my day job, I meet a lot of people that really believe the government's going to be there to protect them.
No.
And I have one word for that. Yeah. Katrina.
Yeah.
You know, the government ceased to function. You either took care of yourself or you died.
Yep.
It was that simple. It was survival of the fittest. And unfortunately, with what they've done to the dollar, that's where we're headed.
Yeah. And one of the things I've been more akin to, whereas some of these guys on the internet are, you know, talking about FEMA camps and, you know, TSA, Vipers, Teams, and, you know, all sorts of federal tyranny and drones and stuff. I said, you know, where we're going, you're going to have to fear, you know, your unprepared neighbors, the, you know, the 1 in 10 Americans who are on antidepressants, who have psychological breaks because they are no longer able to get their antidepressants and just literally go insane. You know, that's what you're going to have to deal with. If people get the chance, do yourself a favor and rent Gone with the Wind. I know here it is a kind of romantic movie, but, you know, watch what Scarlett O'Hara had to do after the Civil War was over and there was people, you know, going through their lands trying to pick out the things. And, you know, there she was with a revolver when the Union soldier was coming after her and she blew his head off. That is the kind of reality that I think is more apt to happen than, you know, armed soldiers or something coming into your house. I mean, most of the military men that at least I speak of, they're going to be more concerned about taking care of their friends and family and probably not doing their duty you know, take care of their friends and family more so than following any unjust orders, which is one of the reasons why there's very few groups out there that I kind of get behind. But to me, the Oath Keepers are one group that I just I give them a lot of credit for putting out the meme of, you know, soldiers need to protect the Constitution. They do not need to follow unlawful orders. And I think that's more of a reality that I think we're going to see. And that's one of the reasons why people need to have the means of defense, especially because most of the people that are in this group are silver stackers. Not only do you need to protect your stack, your food, your kids, your property, but I'm a firm believer that most psychopaths, most people who would try to take advantage of others, only prey on the weakest people out there, the ones that are most defenseless, the ones that are most desperate. And sometimes, just like in your incident with, you know, producing a weapon in the cab, you know, the will to fight, the psychopathic means of taking advantage of another human being is instantly wiped away because that's what a gun does. I forget what the there was one of these gun memes out there that said God made man, and then Smith and Wesson made them equal. And that's what it was.
God made man, and Sam Colt made him equal.
Sam Colt made him equal.
That's the quote. Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, think about the that's one of the things I think is most amazing about you know, firearms, is that any person, I mean, it's the only invention ever that humanity's ever produced where everybody is equal. Because I tell you what, if it's me 6 foot against my wife, I'm going to win. My wife has a gun, all of a sudden I'm on the other side of it. If it's me versus LeBron James, LeBron James is going to win. But me with a gun, I'm able to protect myself from LeBron James. Me as a trained Marine against 20 Marines come, and I'm in a defensible position, I'm pretty confident if I'm in a defensible position with the right weaponry, I'm going to be able to hold off 20, 30, 40, 100 Marines simply because I have the means of protecting myself. And that's the wonderful thing about firearms. It's the only invention ever that protects the individual against a collective, against a psychopath. And it's an immediate a way of doing it. So if people aren't you know, gun savvy or gun fate, even on a philosophical basis, if you're for freedom, you need to own a firearm. You need to train with it. You need to get the right mindset with it in order to, you know, especially going into the type of a political and economic environment that I think we're going to have. Like I said before, it's far better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it.
I agree wholeheartedly with that statement. And the other thing, too, you know, it's not just the firearm. It's the ammunition. Mm-hmm. Obviously, reloading is a hobby, is a subfacet of that hobby or firearms. And the more, you know, the more you're able to reload, cast bullets, whatever, the better off you'll be in the long run. Because if this comes down the way you and I believe it will, mm-hmm. it's very important to have, you know, and I'm not saying you need 100,000 rounds of ammunition. Yeah. But it's very important to have enough that with a government that doesn't function for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, which I think is a real possibility, that you're able to hunt, defend your food, defend your family, and defend your property. And
let's talk about that, because one of the, I guess, mental blocks I've had is I've watched, I have one friend that owns 34 handguns. He lives in New Jersey, and no rifles. And I kind of mocked him and I said, you know, you only have 2 hands. Why do you need 34 handguns? And he's not a guy who's, you know, buying them and flipping them and making a side business out of it. Talk about what, you know, you're an average 45-year-old guy, family of, you know, father of two. You kind of get what's going on. What would you recommend that they do? Like, what type of firearms, how many rounds of ammunition, just to get you through this 2 to 3 year kind of anger phase, I like to call it, where, you know, your government's not probably going to be relied upon. What should people go out and get, train with and work with? What would you recommend?
First off, again, it's what you handle well. Mm-hmm. And for one person, that might be a lever action rifle. For another person, that could be an AR. Mm-hmm. It's, again, I go back to go to the gun range. Get what you are comfortable with. You know, in some states, a la Ben, sorry about your luck, buddy, getting an AR is going to be difficult, if not impossible. Mm-hmm. As far as the amount of ammunition, I don't think I'm being flippant when I say this. I would say bare minimum 1,000 rounds.
Mm-hmm. I would
always have a handgun or two, just, you know, because it's easier to carry a handgun with you if you're out working than it is a rifle. Mm-hmm. But you definitely want a rifle in case you have to hold up and take some pot shots at a long distance. I think, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 weapons is probably enough.
Yeah.
I have significantly more than that, but I'm a collector. Mm-hmm. And I can look at it this way. If you have a lot of firearms chambered for a lot of different calibers, any ammunition that comes your way, you'll be able to use. Mm-hmm. Because I believe, like you, the barter system will be paramount. Mm-hmm. And I've got firearms out there I could trade off if I need something for my family.
Yeah.
That I don't necessarily have a lot of ammunition for. But again, I would have bare minimum 1,000 rounds on hand. And, you know, in my own personal situation, I have about 15 times that, but I also have in excess of 60 firearms.
Yeah.
And it's very important, if you look at the foundation of this country, it's very important that we're able to defend ourselves against, you know, the tyrannical government, and against the fact that our government cannot police itself, cannot rein in spending. And I believe that but what you use the best is what you should own. Mm-hmm. Be that an AR, be that a lever action, be a single shot falling block. You're going to do the best job defending your family with what you shoot the best.
Yeah. The way I went about doing it, and again, I'm not, I own guns. I was in the Marines, but I still am not, you know, somebody who would read up on them or, collect them or go out shooting quite often. The way I looked at it is I knew that I had to have it. So the first thing I bought was a Beretta, and I realized that was my first mistake because I really didn't like shooting it. I wasn't good with it. So the next thing I bought was a home defense gun. So I got a shotgun. Yep. And I knew I was always good with shotguns because I did skeet shooting and, you know, I could, you know, ping those clay pigeons pretty well. So I knew for home defense, if I had to go get something, I wasn't going to go get my 9mm. I was going to go get my shotgun. And I think for home defense, if anybody has a shotgun, that's probably the best thing. Because I tell you what, just racking that first round will probably scare the shit out of anybody that's inside that house. And if it doesn't, that it gives you extra justification for, killing whoever's inside your house. Because chances are there isn't a logical thought going through their mind. So I bought a shotgun and I got probably about a couple hundred rounds, not a whole lot, because my thought was that if I ever got into a situation where I needed to use my shotgun and shoot more than 5 rounds, chances are things weren't going to be good for me anyways, if I couldn't, you know, finish off the target in 5 rounds. So I didn't see the need of owning thousands of rounds of that. I then bought an AR, and that I bought a lot of rounds for, far more than I probably need or ever have. In fact, now that the 5.56 rounds are going up in value, I've been thinking about unloading a couple thousand rounds to go buy more silver, because the silver to 5.56 ratio to me is out of whack. I think that it's weird, but that's the way I value everything. I don't look in dollar terms on anything that I buy. I always look at ratios to silver. But, 5.56 prices have gone up significantly since I loaded up on this stuff. The demand is high for it. In fact, I did a YouTube video where, Fin Feather and Fur, which is a pretty major distributor out here, they didn't have any ammo cans. And when I went and stocked up on them probably 3 years ago, they had a lot of them. And it was 100 rounds per person, per day, to buy 5.56. And the prices were three times what I had bought them for. So, you're right. I think there's a certain value to doing that. And then my last purchase was this, Ruger LC9, because I really wanted something that I could carry. The Beretta was just far too big for me to carry on my person, much less be concealed. I even bought a cool little laser sight for it to kind of dummy it down for me. But to me, if you have a handgun, the handgun is for on your person and in the car. Like, those are the two situations that I would want that around. Home defense, I would want the shotgun, and then the M4 carbine, the M16 type, 30 round magazine. That's for that's if things are really bad. I wouldn't even consider my handgun or my shotgun at that time. I would have that AR or the M4 on me at all times. If things are that bad, I would want nothing else but that.
I would agree, and that's why I own the ARs that I do. But you got to look at what's driving these prices. And
tell me about it, because and this probably gets more into what you're dealing with. I went, and I'm just going to give me kind of a layman's experience. I went to the Fin Feather and Fur a month ago, right after the Sandy Hook shootings. And I tell you what, the Fin Feather and Fur that I went to is in the same mall as a Kmart, and those are the only two stores in the strip mall. The Kmart side of it had maybe 10 to 15 cars, parked on their side of the lot. And Fin Feather and Fur, if there was 200 cars there, I'd probably be under a thing. And it was streams of people going in there. I mean, just, every, young man, old man, or all, just, they were all streaming in there, to the point where I was there with my little son. And not that I was going to buy anything, I just wanted to see what was going on. I saw that there were so many people going in there, that I was like, okay, I get what's going on. They're probably very, very busy. And then I went 3 weeks later, which is, a couple weeks ago, and it was like a picked over, carcass of a Thanksgiving dinner. Like, there wasn't anywhere near the amount of rifles on the wall. There's still a lot of handguns. To me, the handgun prices had gone up significantly. And then the rifles that they did have for sale, and again, I'm not, your site would probably help out a lot more with this, but just my perception was that the rifles had gone up at least 40 or 50% from from what I remember them being, 2 to 3 years ago. And they were for display purposes only. Like, you just couldn't buy any rifle there, because they wouldn't have anything else to show or sell from. So let's go over, your experience with gun values, what's driving it. Give me your feedback on it.
Well, this right now is being driven by the threat of government regulation, primarily. People are afraid they won't be able to get one. You're correct. Ammunition has doubled in price, depending on the ammunition, but anything 223, 5.56, 7.62 by 39, 7.62 by 51, those are all, they've all pretty much doubled. Magazines have in some cases quadrupled. Mm-hmm. The firearms have doubled. Again, assuming a semi-automatic firearm that's currently on the government's radar. Mm-hmm. Shotguns, bolt action rifles really haven't changed much. They've, typical inflation type stuff. Mm-hmm. And you can still get pretty much your pick of shotguns or bolt action rifles if you want them. Revolvers and semi-automatic handguns, they've kind of been carried along in the wave, mm-hmm. and they have gone up some. But the semi-automatic rifles have are definitely the ones. And this same phenomena happened when our current president was elected the first time. Yes. It became nearly impossible to get ammunition, reloading components, anything AR, because they were afraid of what he would do.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. Let's compare Obama's first election, because that's right about I had bought my rifle prior to his election. Simply because I had just moved to Ohio and from New Jersey, which was like heaven for me because you really couldn't buy anything cool in New Jersey. Like all the ARs they had were, small magazine. They didn't have the flash suppressor. They didn't have the shorter stock. They had, all sorts of stuff. So when I came to Ohio, I was like, wow, this is cool. I can actually get build your own, cool gun here. And but as soon as Obama got in, I remember there was a fervor over the guns there. I don't think I was quite attuned to the response and prices, but maybe if you can compare what happened when Obama got in and then what the difference is now, because I think it's much more serious now than the, I guess, knee-jerk reaction of 2008.
It is to a degree. Let's go back even a little further. Let's go back to the assault weapons ban under Bill Clinton. Mm-hmm. The same thing happened there. And what a lot of people don't understand is it takes these manufacturers a long time to refill the pipeline. Mm-hmm. They will tune up their machines to make a certain amount of ammunition. And if they bring on a whole bunch of people and train them to produce this temporary demand, then all of a sudden they're losing money. Mm-hmm. So they don't really ramp up production as much as you'd think. Mm-hmm. It is, as far as anything quote unquote that looks or has to do with an assault rifle, I would say it's 2 to 3 times worse this time than when he was first elected. Mm-hmm. The first time he was elected, it took the manufacturers over a year to refill the pipeline with ammunition, rifles, and components. I would venture to say, depending on how long Congress keeps debating this gun control measure and how long it keeps going in the various states, I would say it might take them 2 to 2.5 years to refill the pipeline. Mm-hmm. After they get through whatever they're going to do. I don't think they can get anything real draconian through on a national level. I think the NRA has done a very good job.
And actually, like when they announced the 22 things that Obama did, I looked at all of them and I'm like, it didn't seem, draconian at all. His executive orders. In fact, I thought it was more of a punt. But the threat is still out there, but I think that people are far more got their feet in the ground about this issue. I'm usually not one to talk about gun control or anything else, but I did a lot of videos talking about you can't ban evil and all the different aspects of gun control and the different things that are far more expensive. But even when I was at the gun shop a couple of weeks ago, I started talking to him about what kind of demand he was seeing and what his expectations were, and he said that the guy that owns the store said it's going to take at the very least 8 to 9 months for them to come back. But he immediately said after that, he goes, but I think something has intrinsically changed in the market this time around, where I don't think that even 8 to 9 months they're going to be able to pick it up. Because that every time we do get a break or we get something in, the fervor of purchasing these things is much stronger than he's ever seen it before. And that, specifically the 30-round mags, he says, I don't know how that's going to get resolved because there's just such a huge backlog on them that I don't know how they're going to get back to normal on that.
Again, I agree with that. Let me tell you the story that happened. This was 2 weeks after the Newtown shootings. Mm-hmm. I went to our local gun show. The line to get in the door was over 100 yards long. Mm-hmm. So I looked at my friend that had gone with me, and I said, I don't need anything in there that bad, and he agreed. So we went to our local Cabela's, which is, our sporting goods store outfitter out here, and the shelves were bare. handguns were down to a bare minimum. There wasn't an AR type rifle to be had. All that was there was bolt action rifles and shotguns primarily. Mm-hmm. So we wandered over to the optics counter and we were talking to the optics salesman, and he related this story to us. He said they had gotten 6 AR rifles in the previous week. Mm-hmm. When they unlocked the doors that morning, there were 10 guys standing at the front door. And it was a foot race to the gun counter to get your numbers to be waited on. And the guys who got numbers 1 through 6 took those 6 ARs. Mm-hmm. Sold within 10 minutes of Cabela's receiving them. This is a major national retailer. Mm-hmm. And he said, it's so bad right now, they will not special order you a gun. Mm-hmm. And my daughter's 21st birthday is coming up very shortly, and she has her heart set on a specific revolver that she's wanted for years. And I currently cannot find one for sale in the United States. I agree that I don't know that it's permanently changed. I think it's changed for the duration of this administration. Mm-hmm. I think that, and it may be permanent. And I think you're going to see it continue to be very, very hard to get ammunition and components and rifles. And as long as this goes on, and again, it's going to take them another year once it dies down, if it ever does, to refill the pipeline.
Yeah. And it's funny because when I did the quick YouTube video, I said now is not the time to be going out and really like buying this stuff, because I feel like, if you don't have anything, yeah, get something. But I told people, I said, 2 years ago, there was a run on storable food. Like that had a 6-month backlog because there were just, I forget what was going on, but it was probably Katrina or something along those lines. But there was a backlog of storable food where you couldn't get it for 6 months. Now that there is no backlog on storable food, I said, really, now's the time to be buying storable food and not chasing after this market. And the kind of the same thing with silver. Yeah, there's some weight for silver, but it's not anywhere near what you're seeing there. So what I've been trying to tell people is be anti chasing the shiny object and start storing up on things that they need. That, you know, to me, I think silver's important, I think food's important, I think ammo's important. But don't just kind of buy into what everybody else is doing. Tell me about this site that you got, mygunvalues.com. Mm-hmm. How did you get involved in doing this? Like, what is the impetus behind this?
Well, the impetus behind it, as we discussed earlier, was A, to make my living doing my hobby, what I love to do. Mm-hmm. That was the impetus behind it. Mm-hmm. Obviously, and in my day job, I am an appliance technician, have my own appliance repair company. Mm-hmm. When I go out and repair an appliance, it's fixed, I'm done, the customer pays me, hopefully everybody's happy, and I leave. I got to go out and repair another appliance to continue to earn that money. With this site, as long as we update it and keep it current, it's nationwide. It gives us a constant opportunity for income. And two, it really helps those people who, I should back this up, 10 to 15% of the people in the United States that own firearms are what the industry refers to as churners. Mm-hmm. We're the people that, like myself, that have multiple firearms, that buy all the new toys that come out. We're where the firearms industry makes their profit. Mm-hmm. This site is built for the 85% that are like you. Mm-hmm. Have 3 or 4 guns. Hey, I want to know what they're worth in case they get stolen. Mm-hmm. In case that I want to sell them and the dealers tell me, well, it's only worth $150. You have a house fire and they burn to the ground. And you lose them. This is what that site's built for. That was the impetus behind it. And I wanted it to be usable for the common person, because again, if the simpler you keep it, the happier people will be. And that's what I've tried to do with this, is make it so the average person can understand it.
Where did you get the values, and like, how is this like updated? Like, to me, it's just such a huge database. It's got to be either a real labor of love, or you got something going on. So tell me, like, how you got Ben involved, and where you got this.
As we had actually gone through 2 other programmers, mm-hmm. and neither one of them was willing to work, shall we say, when my partner Bill found Ben. Ben has proved to be very knowledgeable, not only on the database side, but he's helped us some with the marketing as well. Mm-hmm. And that's where he came into the picture primarily. And I'm sorry, what was the first part of that question?
I guess, like, where did you get all
the value
database and values and like?
There are multiple firearms auction sites out there. Mm-hmm. There's multiple dealers out there. We took without divulging too much, each value you see is the result of an algorithm mm-hmm. that I designed mm-hmm. and, actually took me several months to design it. Mm-hmm. And it's based on actual sales of firearms. Of course, you had to have a starting point.
Yeah.
And we went through and researched, and that really is what took a lot of the time on these firearms, because the same model chambered in a different caliber could have a completely different value.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And because of rarity, primarily. Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of this came in. But they are updated, obviously. And then we use on firearms that are still produced today, mm-hmm. most manufacturers use an MSRP. Usually high. You can usually, real world pricing is usually quite a bit less.
Yeah, like 20-30% I found.
Usually.
Yeah.
And that's also factored in there as well. It's a multi-step process. Like, I don't want to get too deep into it because but it's, and I'll say this much too. It was an answer to prayer too for me, because, it was, it was, okay, God, how do I do this? I have the idea. Mm-hmm. How do I do this? And those answers came to me over time, over the first year of this development, mm-hmm. of how to develop this algorithm and how to make it work. And there's actually 24 algorithms, and each firearm is assigned one of those 24 algorithms mm-hmm. to calculate its values.
And does this, like, if it doesn't, you guys should do it. Does it, like, track, if values are going up or down, or what's hot and what's not? Like, to me, I think that, I look at, like, Zillow. I guess it would be kind of an equivalent site where it would say, okay, here's the houses that are for sale. Here's the values of it going up and down and stuff like that. Does it do that?
Yes. Yes. We have updated, everything is updated as need be. Obviously, there is in some instances, there's a real world lag because it does take us time to get this data put in there. Mm-hmm. We do that. Also, one thing we do is we tell you what you could reasonably expect a dealer to pay for it. Because, I mean, if you take your firearms into your local dealer,
there's a wholesale price and a retail price.
They got to make money on it.
Yeah.
We tell you what you could expect. As an example, we have a local dealer here who's kind of known for not being the most honest guy on the planet. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine took him in a rifle. It's worth $400.
Yeah.
Well, $300 to $400, depending on who you're selling it to that day. He walked in, the dealer says, all right, and he said, that's only worth $50. That's all, I'll give it to you. Mm-hmm. And he turned around and put $450 on it on his shelf.
There's
a living and a killing.
Yeah.
And this is, again, for those people, so they know, so they're not taken advantage of.
Yeah.
And if the dishonest dealers don't like the site, that's fine by me.
Yeah, drive them out. Yeah, I told you guys before the call. I said, that's like a YouTube video you should make, like the top five things to watch out for when you're selling your gun or buying your gun, or what to look for, something like that. But yeah, people always like to have the tricks of the trade shown, because I think that's where all of humanity is eventually going to get to, where there's just so much information on the internet that the ability for scams and for dishonest people to, kind of the tricks of the trade, so to speak, are eventually going to go away, because there's just too much transparency. There's too many people out there who, got burned once and will make sure that no one else gets burned by this again. So I like that kind of backing on it.
We if I could jump in here for a second.
Yeah.
I went out to see Dave last year, and we went to a large gun show in his area, mm-hmm. and
Can you just speak up a little bit, Ben?
Oh, I'm sorry. We went to a large gun show in Dave's area, and we went in there, and basically we weren't going to buy anything, but we went around to all of the tables, and Dave's stepfather had an iPhone that he could get the internet on in there. So we actually used the site to go around and see, like, okay, so what do they have it selling at, and what do we have it listed as? And we specifically looked for models that, like, we knew were the most updated prices in there. Mm-hmm. And we found that pretty consistently at the gun show, had stuff marked up 10-15%, which, you know, if you were going to sell it and you know somebody's going to haggle with you, that kind of makes sense. So it
And also the I guess the mentality of the gun show, where it really is like a buyer's frenzy. I mean, you get people lined up to go to these places. Like, you know, there's a gun show in the county I'm in once a month, same thing, just lines out the door. They keep jacking up the prices at the door, and you know, you go in there, and there's a lot of guns in there, but it's not, I don't know, there's a lot of, like, people looking and stuff like that. But when you go into, like, a retail store, you know, they have a lot of inventory, and they have overhead expenses. It's not just, you know, renting a table and, you know, once a month and, you know, making a killing during the time. You know, you have more of a streamlined business model. So I would imagine the gun show prices are a little bit higher than just your typical retailer, where you probably negotiate down thing. Is that right? Or
That's part of it. Yeah. Gun shows are as much about selling, or I shouldn't say that. I said that the wrong way. Gun shows are as much about a social event as they are about selling for a lot of guys. Mm-hmm. A lot of the guys that you see with tables there have been going there for years. Mm-hmm. And they go there to see their buddies and to talk guns. And they will price things. It's not uncommon to see some firearms 50, 60, 70% overpriced because they really don't want to sell them.
They just want to go there.
It literally is just a matter. And if they sell one, hey, great, they made a killing.
Yeah.
But they really don't want to sell their gun. And that's the kind of guys you've got to avoid when you go into those, is you might find a gun that you really want, but they don't really want to sell it, so you're not going to get anywhere negotiating with them.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's where the retail environment, if you can find an honest retailer, is a lot of times better. Yeah. You know, with gun shows, once you learn the guys, you know who you can deal with and who you can't. Hmm. But that's the biggest thing, is they're a social event. So when you see guys that are 55 and over, a lot of them aren't there to make money. A lot of them are there are just to yak with people that believe the same things they do.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a culture that goes in there, because it's funny. I have the guy that built my AR. He's a lieutenant in the police force, and when he starts talking about guns, you know, my eyes roll in the back of my head, and I'm mildly interested. But man, he just gets into, like, this, you know, deep involved in, like, the history and the, you know, the manufacturer's defect and, you know, find the right thing, and then, you know, the different colors of steel. Like, I mean, he's really into this, and I'm glad that he enjoys it, because you know, that's his passion. And I recommend that everybody find their passion. I mean, I don't care if you're, like, the Beanie Baby, you know, dude. You know, find something that you love doing, and do it. You know, stop, I think that's the ultimate crime of this paradigm, is that I think that so many people's lives have been wasted chasing things that mean nothing to them, only because our society or indoctrination system thinks that that's what they need. You know, we're really indoctrinated into working for corporations, working for governments, or working for military, and very rarely do we have people who have followed their own passion, their own dreams, and do things that they enjoy doing. They do it because they make money. I certainly was a perfect example of that. I was in the car business because my family was. I was good at it, and I made money, but I hated it. I hate going to work every day. I hated the whole process of what I was doing. And I think that this, you know, reset, this collapse, whatever you want to call it, this anger phase that's coming, people are going to have to reevaluate what they're doing with their lives. And, you know, I talk about how this revolution or the evolution is coming. It is more about a consciousness revolution. It's not a political fight, a financial battle, or a military battle. It's about what we're actively or passively supporting with our lives. And collectively, all these individuals, what we're consciously doing with our lives is affecting the whole of humanity. And I constantly refer to the debt and death paradigm. Somewhere along the line, you know, majority of the people are actively or passively supporting the debt and death paradigm, whether it's their corporate jobs, whether it's the, you know, the production that they do, whether it's the debt that they create, like I certainly did in my prior life. We're all a part of this, and that I think the solution is for individually for people to walk away and start, you know, not needing as much. I mean, that's a whole nother facet. Like, you know, once you realize that you don't have to keep up with the Joneses and have a new car every 3 years and, you know, the big house and stuff like that, you start to see that your real needs are much lower and much smaller and less, you know, much more attainable. And then you need less of an intense lifestyle to do that. And then you don't have to sell yourself out as much. And maybe you can start with a hobby that flourishes into a small business simply because you're passionate about it. So I give you guys a lot of credit for doing this. Ben, you know, he's not quite out of it, and maybe you're not either, David, but keep up with this, and I'm sure good things will come. Tell me about what you guys are going to do with YouTube, because I think that there's a huge benefit for you guys to get onto YouTube. You know, I had my own blog for a year, and you know, the response was decent. You know, you do an article or so and get it out to a couple places, but the YouTube seems to be the place to go. And I've just stumbled across a lot of like gun specific channels that are just huge, and you know, they really don't do much. They either shoot them or review them. Have you guys thought about what you plan on doing for that?
I mean, as you can tell, like, Dave knows, you know, he's a wealth of information about all of these subjects. And, you know, we're going to be releasing a lot of we had planned on using YouTube as a sort of how to use our site and to put videos up and things like that. But then I think the direction that we're going to go with it now is to tell people, okay, here's what you to show people, here's how you can look for a quality firearm. Here's how you can determine the condition of the firearm. Here's how you figure out what the barrel length is on this, and all sorts of different subjects like that. I think, you know, I think you're absolutely right about how people are going to YouTube for this type of information. There was a guy in my area who went to one of the information. I'm in Western New York, mm-hmm. So we've been sort of reeling from this gun ban that they have here, and they had an informational meeting about how what the new laws were going to be. Well, the room was so packed. It was literally standing room only, going out the door, people standing outside the door of the room trying to hear what was going on. And he just took a video of this,
yeah,
and put together the people's comments. And within like 3 days, he had 300,000 views on it.
Yeah.
That's
amazing, because I haven't had that kind of response with all my videos.
And it was crazy, and he's not even a big YouTuber or anything. Yeah. He just put this up there. So a lot of the things that I see on YouTube, and you know, I've spent my share of time watching some of those videos because I'm kind of a learner right mm-hmm. now. A lot of it is one, people talking about all of the tactical attachments they put onto their, you know, Mossberg 500 and with the pistol grip, and then the Picatinny rail, and all the accoutrements that they put on these things. And to me, that information is great if you're into that, but it's not realistic for most people, because honestly, are they going to go and buy a $500 shotgun and then put $1,500 of aftermarket attachments on it.
Yeah.
You know, it's. For me, I would rather get laser eye surgery to make myself shoot better.
Yeah.
But a lot of what we're going to try and provide on our YouTube channel is practical information for people who want to educate themselves about what they can do, and give them sort of almost a minimal amount of information so they're not overloaded right away.
Yeah.
And then also create videos to show them how to make sure that you're not getting ripped off. And we also have a blog that we're going to be supplementing that information with. But yeah. When you suggested the YouTube thing, and you know, we really thought about it, and we're like, yeah, that's definitely going to be an important aspect of it. So,
well, good. I give you guys a lot of credit for doing this, and you know, I wanted to thank you guys for coming on and talking about this. I was just doing a quick Google. Before I talked about how the firearm is the equalizing force against the collective. And here's a little homework assignment for everybody. I want you to Google SIMO, S-I-M-O, and then Hayha, H-A-Y-H-A. And he is the most highly called the White Death. And when Finland was invaded by the Russians, this single man, who's only 5'2", ended up holding off the entire Red Army by having a 505 sniper kills. This little man, who ended up living out to being 96 years old, held off the entire Red Army, and that's why Finland was not conquered during World War II. And it's an incredible story. In fact, I wanted to do a video strictly about him. About the power of one man with one rifle being able to hold off a collective. So there is a lot of philosophical reasons for owning firearms. There's a moral reason, I believe, to do it. And like we said earlier, if you are going to own one, make sure you're trained. Make sure that you're going to never bring it out unless you plan on using it. Never bring it out unless you plan on killing somebody. So there's a lot to this. So. You guys have any final thoughts before we go?
I guess one thing that's really been on my mind lately, going through what we're going through in New York, is sort of like a mini, stuff hits the fan moment here.
Yep, yep.
Because, right now, today, you can no longer get many firearms. It's mm-hmm. as if, like, the stores are closed, locked, shelves empty. And I would just encourage people, if this is something that you think you might need, it's probably a good idea to start doing your research and get what you need now.
Yeah, that's a really good point because, even during the assault rifles ban, they didn't confiscate rifles. I mean, there's tons of rifles out there. They really cut down the new sales of it and maybe resales of it. But the point is that even if you're probably not into it now, get it anyways, because once they're not being able to be sold, it's a little too late to go out there and kind of close the barn door after the horses have left. My suggestion to you, Ben, is, you need to move. I could not be, I have I did a strategy session with a gentleman who lives in Australia, and he's like, what do I do? I said, honestly, I could not live in a place knowing what I know now, knowing what's coming down the road, and not have the means of protecting myself. This talks about, what are we actively or passively supporting in our lives? And if it's something where, just simply being in a state that doesn't resonate with you, well, move to Texas, man. In fact, I saw Texas did some sort of advertising to New York, residents, like, come down here, the taxes are lower, the economy's booming, and yeah, we can own the guns.
I think that's great. Actually, my wife looked at me. We were at the sporting goods store, and I tried to buy a AR-7, which is a little dinky. You know, it's not dinky, but it collapses into the stock, so it's real easy to throw in a backpack or something like that. And but it had an 8-round magazine with it, and the law says you can only have 7-round magazines now. Yeah. And so they wouldn't sell it to me for one bullet. And my wife looked at me and she's like, "Okay, are you ready to leave yet?" Because you know, so
yeah. And as if this winter isn't bad enough, I don't know. Are you getting nailed with all the snow?
Yeah, there's at least a foot out there. I've been staying inside because it's pretty bad out there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean that's great advice, and you know, hopefully this site will make that a little more possible for me. Yeah.
David, so, you have any final thoughts for us about you know, anything that you got?
I'd like to talk to the people that think, you know, we've discussed gun control a lot. I'd like to talk a minute for the people that think it doesn't affect them. Mm-hmm. I told you earlier, I have 2,000 magazines and reference books. I have a complete set of American Rifleman magazines from 1946. In there is an article written by a British fellow that says, "I don't know what you Yanks are all upset about gun control for. All we do here in England is we go down and renew our permit every 3 years, and it's no problem." Mm-hmm. And what's happening is they're surrendering their rights to the government. Mm-hmm. And today in England, you can no longer own a handgun. Mm-hmm. For God's sake, the Queen's husband has to go to Switzerland to shoot pistols. Okay, if you allow the government to dictate what you can own and how you can use it, then, you know, it does affect you.
Yeah.
And if it's firearms today, what happens next time if they decide that, and this is a little more real than you think, pickup trucks use too much gas. We're going to outlaw all pickup trucks. Mm-hmm. Where does it stop? So it's important now to exercise your rights and to take that stand. I don't care if you don't want to own a firearm, but don't tell other people they can't.
Yeah.
Because it is a right guaranteed by our Constitution, and I don't believe the government has any power to restrict it at all, and I believe the law New York just passed is unconstitutional.
Yeah, and I did video called "They Can't Take Your Rights Away, You Can Only Give Them Away." And I am a firm believer, if they've, you know, said that everything that I owned is illegal, I just then become, you know, illegal in their eyes and only, you know, more justified in mine. There is a line in my life to me that, you know, they can pass whatever laws that they want, but the moment that they try to enforce something that I know is intrinsically right to my free existence, that's the line. And, you know, just the same way as if somebody tried to kidnap my children, I would react the same way if somebody tried to take my guns or my silver or my house or, you know, my wife or something along those lines. There's just a line you don't cross. And I think that's ultimately where these guys are going to fail, is when they try to, you know, kind of jump the shark and make it something far more, because right now it's kind of in theory, it's kind of, you know things, but you know, the day that we actually have agents who are doing you know, mass gun raids and trying to disarm people and stuff like that, I don't see it happening. And if it did, I don't see a lot of police officers, you know, standing by and saying, "Oh yeah, this is what I signed up for, to disarm my neighbor who I've known for 20 years and who's owned guns this whole time," or, you know, or you know, even the police officers that I know, they're more gun nuts. They love guns. They love the whole idea of the Second Amendment. They don't mind citizens owning their guns because they feel that, you know, if other responsible citizens have guns, it's only more protection for them. But yeah, this is a very big issue. I don't see a complete ban coming, regardless whatever hype is out there. You know, I don't know. That's all I got to say about that.
I agree. But if they, and for the people that don't, okay, it's been made very public here recently that Great Britain only had 36 gun murders last year. Mm-hmm. Okay. Your incidence of being a victim of violent crime in Great Britain is one out of, I believe the statistic is one out of 379. That includes robbery, rape, assault, things of that nature. Your chance of becoming a victim of a violent crime in the United States is one out of 800. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're actually, to look at it that way, you have less than half the chance of being a victim of a violent crime in the United States, and if you interview the criminals, they'll tell you why.
Yep, because they know.
Don't know if that house they're going to break into, if they're going to run into a firearm or not.
Yep.
And that's in Britain. They know the citizens are helpless sheep.
Yep.
And they don't care.
Yep.
They're going to do what they want to do. So that's all part and parcel of it also.
Well, guys, this, I think, was a very valuable discussion. I've wanted to talk about firearms, but I felt like I didn't have the, more than the basics. And I learned a lot from this discussion. So, I wish you guys luck with the site. And, once you get a YouTube channel or something going on, you can go to mygunvalues.com. You can check it out. Maybe if this issue gets hot again, we'll bring you guys both back on and we'll talk a little bit further about it. But I thank you a lot for being on.
Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity, Chris.
Yeah, it was great. And Ben, I'll keep in touch with you, and we'll go from there. Thanks a lot, guys.
Right. Thank you.
All right, bye. Take care.